This is Rachel with Radio Talking Book Network in Omaha, Nebraska. I will be reading Bookshelf, starting with part 12 of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Something seemed to affect his imagination, for he put his fingers to his ears and shut his eyes, screwing them up tightly, just as a small boy does when his face is being soaped. There was something pathetic in it that touched me. It also gave me a lesson, for it seemed that before me was a child. Only a child, though the features were worn, and the stubble on the jaws was white. It was evident that he was undergoing some process of mental disturbance, and, knowing how his past moods had interpreted things seemingly foreign to himself, I thought I would enter into his mind as well as I could, and go with him. The first step was to restore confidence, so I asked him, speaking pretty loud so that he would hear me through his closed ears, "Would you like some sugar to get your flies round again?" He seemed to wake up all at once and shook his head. With a laugh, he replied, "Not much. Flies are poor things after all." After a pause, he added, "But I don't want their souls buzzing around me all the same." "Or spiders?" I went on. "Blow spiders. What's the use of spiders? There isn't anything in them to eat or..." He stopped suddenly, as though reminded of a forbidden topic. So, I thought to myself, this is the second time he suddenly stopped at the word drink. What does it mean? Renfield seemed himself aware of having made a lapse, for he hurried on, as though to distract my attention from it. "I don't take any stock at all in such matters. Rats and mice and such small deer, as Shakespeare has it, chicken feed of the larder, they might be called. I'm past all that sort of nonsense. You might as well ask a man to eat molecules with a pair of chopsticks as to try to interest me about the lesser Carnanova, for I know of what it is before me." "I see," I said. "You want big things that you can make your teeth meet in. How would you like to breakfast on elephant?" "What ridiculous nonsense you're talking." He was getting too wide awake, so I thought I would press him hard. "I wonder," I said reflectively, "what an elephant's soul is like." The effect I desired was obtained, for he at once fell from his high horse and became a child again. "I don't want an elephant's soul, or any soul at all," he said. For a few moments he sat despondently. Suddenly he jumped to his feet, with his eyes blazing and all the signs of intense cerebral excitement. "To hell with you and your souls," he shouted. "Why do you plague me about souls? Haven't I got enough to worry and pain and distract me already without thinking of souls?" He looked so hostile, I thought that he was in for another homicidal fit, so I blew my whistle. The instant, however, I did so, he became calm and said apologetically, "Forgive me, doctor, I forgot myself. You do not need any help. I am so worried in my mind that I am apt to be irritable. If you only knew the problem I have to face, and that I'm working out, you would pity and tolerate and pardon me. Pray do not put me in a strait waistcoat. I want to think, and I cannot think freely when my body is confined. I'm sure you'll understand." He had evidently self-control, so when the attendants came, I told them not to mind, and they withdrew. Renfield watched them go. When the door was closed, he said, with considerable dignity and sweetness, "Dr. Seward, you've been very considerate towards me. Believe me, I am very, very grateful to you." I thought it well to leave him in this mood, and so I came away. There is something certainly to ponder over in this man's state. Several points seem to make what the American interviewer calls a story, if one could only get them in proper order. Here they are. Will not mention drinking. Fears the thought of being burdened with the soul of anything. Has no dread of wanting life in the future. Despises the meaner forms of life altogether, though he dreads being haunted by their souls. Logically, all of these things point to one way. he has assurance of some kind that he will acquire some higher life. He dreads the consequence, the burden of soul. Then it is a human life he looks to. And the assurance? Merciful God, the Count has been to him, and there is some new scheme of terror afoot. Later, I went after my round to Van Helsing and told him of my suspicion. He grew very grave, and, after thinking the matter over for a while, asked me to take him to Renfield. I did so. As we came to the door, we heard the lunatic within singing gaily, as he used to do in the time which now seems so long ago. When we entered, we saw with amazement that he had spread out his sugar, as of old. The flies, lethargic with the autumn, were beginning to buzz into the room. We tried to make him talk of the subject of our previous conversation, but he would not attend. He went on with his singing, just as though we had not even been present. He got a scrap of paper and was folding it into a notebook. We had to come away as ignorant as we went in. His is a curious case indeed. We must watch him tonight. Letter, Mitchell, Sons, and Candy to Lord Godalming, 1st of October. My lord, we are, at times, only too happy to meet your wishes. We beg, with regard to the desire of your lordship expressed by Mr. Harker on your behalf, to supply the following information concerning the sale and purchase of number 347 Piccadilly. The original vendors are the executors of the late Mr. Archibald Winter Suffield. The purchaser is a foreign nobleman, Count Deville, who effected the purchase himself, paying the purchase money in notes over the counter, if your lordship will pardon us using so vulgar an expression. Beyond this, we know nothing whatever of him. We are, my lord, your lordship's humble servants, Mitchell, Sons, and Candy. Dr. Seward's Diary, 2nd of October. I placed a man in the corridor tomorrow night, or last night, and told him to make an accurate note of any sound he might hear from Renfield's room, and gave him instructions that if there should be anything strange, he was to call me. After dinner, when we'd all gathered round the fire in the study, and Mrs. Harker having gone to bed, we discussed the attempts and discoveries of the day. Harker was the only one who had any result, and we're in great hopes that his clue may be an important one. Before going to bed, I went round to the patient's room and looked in through the observation trap. He's sleeping soundly, and his heart rose and fell with regular respiration. This morning, the man on duty reported to me that a little after midnight he was restless, and kept saying his prayers somewhat loudly. I asked him if that was all. He replied it was all that he heard. There was something about his manner so suspicious that I asked him point blank if he had been asleep. He denied sleep, but admitted to having dozed for a while. It is too bad that men cannot be trusted unless they're watched. Today, Harker is out following up on his clue, and Art and Quincy are looking after horses. Godalming thinks that it will be well to have horses always in readiness, for when we get the information which we seek, there will be no time to lose. We must sterilize all of the imported earth between sunrise and sunset. We shall thus catch the Count at his weakest and without a refuge to fly to. Van Helsing is off to the British Museum looking up some authorities on ancient medicine. The old physicians took account of things which their followers do not accept, and the professor is searching for witch and demon cures which may be useful to us later. I sometimes think we must all be mad, and that we shall wake to sanity in strait waistcoats. Later. We have met again. It seems at last that to be on the track, and our work of tomorrow may be the beginning of the end. I wonder if Renfield's quiet has anything to do with this. His moods have so followed the doings of the Count that the coming destruction of the monster may be carried out to him in some subtle way. If we could only get some hint as to what passed in his mind between the time of my argument with him today and his resumption of fly-catching, it might afford us a valuable clue. He is now seemingly quiet for a spell. Is he? That wild yell seemed to come from his room. The attendant came bursting into my room and told me that Renfield has somehow met with some accident. He heard him yell, and when he went to him, found him lying on his face on the floor, all covered with blood. I must go at once. Dr. Seward's Diary, 3rd of October. Let me put down with exactness all that happened, as well as I can remember it since I last made an entry. Not a detail that I can recall must be forgotten. In all calmness, I must proceed. When I came to Renfield's room, I found him lying on the floor, on his left side, in a glittering pool of blood. When I went to move him, it became apparent all at once that he had received some terrible injuries. There seemed none of that unity of purpose between the parts of the body which marks even lethargic sanity. As the face was exposed, I could see that it was horribly bruised, as though it had been beaten against the floor. Indeed, it was from the face wounds that the pool of blood originated. The attendant who was kneeling beside the body said to me as we turned him over, "I think, sir, his back is broken. See, both his right arm and leg and the whole side of his face are paralyzed." How such a thing could have happened puzzled the attendant beyond measure. He seemed quite bewildered, and his brows were gathered in as he said, "I can't understand the two things." He could mark his face like that, by beating his own head on the ground. I saw a young woman do it once at the Eversfield Asylum before anyone could lay hands on her. And I suppose he might have broke his back by falling out of bed if he got it in an awkward kink. But for the life of me, I can't imagine how the two things occurred. If his back was broke, he couldn't beat his head, and if his face was like that before the fall out of bed, there would be marks of it. I said to him, "Go to Dr. Van Helsing. Ask him to kindly come here at once. I want him here without an instant's delay." The man ran off, and within a very few minutes, the professor, in his dressing gown and slippers, appeared. When he saw Renfield on the ground, he looked keenly at him a moment and turned to me. I think he recognized my thought in my eyes, for he said very quietly, manifestly for the ears of the attendant, "Ah, a sad accident. He will need very careful watching and much attention. I shall stay with you myself, but I shall first dress myself. If you will remain, I shall be in a few minutes join you." The patient was now breathing stertorously, and it was easy to see that he had suffered some terrible injury. Van Helsing returned with extraordinary celerity, bearing with him a surgical case. He had evidently been thinking and had his mind made up, for almost before he looked at the patient, he whispered to me, "Send the attendant away. We must be alone with him when he becomes conscious, after the operation." So I said, "I think that will do now, Simmons. We've done all we can at present. You better go to your round, and Dr. Van Helsing will operate. Let me know instantly if there's anything unusual anywhere." The man withdrew, and we went into a strict examination of the patient. The wounds of the face were superficial. The real injury was a depressed fracture of the skull, extending right through the motor area. The professor thought a moment and said, "We must reduce the pressure and get back to normal conditions as far as can be. The rapidity of the suffusion shows the terrible nature of his injury. The whole motor area seems affected. The suffusion of the brain will increase quickly, so we must trepan him at once, or it may be too late." As he was speaking, there was a soft tapping at the door. I went over and opened it, and found in the corner without Arthur and Quincy in pajamas and slippers. The former spoke.
"I heard your man call up to Van Helsing and tell him of the accident. So I woke Quincy. Rather, called to him as he was not asleep. Things are moving too quickly and too strangely for sound sleep at any of these times. I've been thinking that tomorrow night we'll not see things as they have been. We'll have to look back and forward a little more than we've done. May we come in?"
I nodded, and held the door open till they had entered. Then I closed it again. When Quincy saw the attitude and state of the patient and noted the horrible pool on the floor, he said horribly, softly,
"My God, what has happened to him? Poor, poor devil."
I told him briefly, and added that we expected he would recover consciousness after the operation, for a short time, at all events. He went at once and sat down on the edge of the bed with Godalming beside him, and we all watched in patience.
"We shall wait," said Van Helsing, "just long enough to fix the best spot for trepanning, that we may most quickly and perfectly remove the blood clot, for it is evident that the hemorrhage is increasing."
The minutes during which we waited passed with fearful slowness. I had a horrible sinking in my heart, and from Van Helsing's face I gathered that he felt some fear or apprehension as to what was to come. I dreaded the words that Renfield might speak. I was positively afraid to think, but the conviction of what was coming on me as I read of men who have heard of the Death Watch. The poor man's breathing came in uncertain gasps. Each instant he seemed as though he would open his eyes and speak, but would then follow a prolonged, stertorous breath, and he would relapse into a more fixed insensibility. Inured as I was to sickbeds and death, this suspense grew and grew upon me. I could almost hear the beating of my own heart, and the blood surging through my temples sounded like blows from a hammer. The silence began agonizing. I looked at my companions, one after another, and saw from their flushed faces and damp brows that they were enduring equal torture. There was a nervous suspense over all of us, as though overhead some dread bell would peal out powerfully when we should least expect it. At last, there came a time when it was evident that the patient was sinking fast. He might die at any moment. I looked up at the professor and caught his eyes fixed on mine. His face was sternly set as he spoke. "There is no time to lose. His words may be worth many lives. I've been thinking so as I stood here. There may be is a soul at stake. We shall operate above the ear." Without another word, he made the operation. For a few moments, the breathing continued to be stertorous. Then there came a breath so prolonged it seemed as though it would tear open his chest. Suddenly, his eyes opened and became fixed in a wild, helpless stare. This was continued for a few moments. Then it softened into a glad surprise, and from the lips came a sigh of relief. He moved convulsively. As he did so, he said, "I'll be quiet, doctor. Tell them to take off the strait waistcoat. I've had a terrible dream, and it has left me so weak I cannot move. What's wrong with my face? It feels all swollen, and it smarts dreadfully." He tried to turn his head, but even with the effort, his eyes seemed to grow glassy again, so I gently put it back. Then Van Helsing said in a quiet, grave tone, "Tell us your dream, Mr. Renfield." As he heard the voice, his face brightened through its mutilation, and he said, "That is Dr. Van Helsing. How good of it is it for you to be here? Give me some water, my lips are dry, and I shall tell you. I dreamed..." He stopped and seemed fainting. I called quietly to Quincy, "The brandy, it's in my study, quick." He flew and returned with a glass, the decanter of brandy, and a carafe of water. We moistened the parched lips, and the patient quickly revived. It seemed, however, that his poor injured brain had been working in the interval, for when he was quite conscious, he looked at me piercingly, with an agonized confusion which I shall never forget, and said, "I must not deceive myself. It was no dream, but all a grim reality." Then his eyes roved about the room. As they caught sight of the two figures sitting patiently on the edge of the bed, he went on, "If I were not sure already, I would know from them." For an instant, his eyes closed, not with pain or sleep, but voluntarily, as though he were bringing all of his faculties to bear. When he opened them, he said, hurriedly, with more energy than he had yet displayed, "Quick, doctor, quick, I'm dying. I feel that I have but a few minutes, and then I must go back to death, or worse. Wet my lips with brandy again. I have something I must say before I die, or before my poor crushed brain dies anyhow. Thank you. It was that night, after you left me, when I implored you to let me go away. I couldn't speak then, for I felt my tongue was tied. But I was as sane then, except in that way, as I am now. I was in an agony of despair for a long time after you left me. It seemed hours. Then there came a sudden peace to me. My brain seemed to become cool again, and I realized where I was. I heard the dogs bark behind our house, but not where he was." As he spoke, Van Helsing's eyes never blinked, but his hand came out and met mine and gripped it hard. He did not, however, betray himself. He nodded slightly and said, "Go on," in a low voice. Renfield proceeded. "He came up to the window in the mist, as I had seen him often before. But he was solid then, not a ghost, and his eyes were fierce like a man's when angry. He was laughing with his red mouth. The sharp white teeth glinted in the moonlight when he turned to look back over the belt of trees to where the dogs were barking. I wouldn't ask him to come in at first, though I know he wanted to, just as he had wanted all along. Then he began promising me things, not in words, but by doing them. He was interrupted by a word from the professor. How? By making them happen. Just as he used to send in the flies when the sun was shining, big, fat ones with steel and sapphire on their wings, and big moths in the night with skulls and crossbones on their backs. Van Helsing nodded to him as he whispered to me unconsciously, "The Acherontia atropos of the sphinges, what you call the death's head moth." The patient went on without stopping. Then he began to whimper. Rats, 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 hundreds, thousands, millions of them, and everyone a life, and dogs to eat them, and cats too. All lives, all red blood with years of life in it, and not merely buzzing flies. I laughed at him, for I wanted to see what he would do. Then the dogs howled away beyond the dark trees in his house. He beckoned me to the window. I got up and looked out, and he raised his hands and seemed to call out without using any words. A dark mass spread over the grass, coming on like the shape of a flame to fire, and then he moved the mist to the right and left, and I could see that there were thousands of rats with their eyes blazing red like his, only smaller. He held up his hand, and they all stopped. And I thought he seemed to be saying, "All these lives I will give you. Aye, and many more, and greater through countless ages, if you fall down and worship me." And then a red cloud, like the color of blood, seemed to close over my eyes, and before I knew what I was doing, I found myself opening the sash and saying to him, "Come in, Lord and Master." The rats were all gone, but he slid into the room through the sash, though it was only open an inch wide, just as the moon herself has often come in through the tiniest crack, and has stood before me in all her size and splendor. His voice was weaker, so I moistened his lips with the brandy again, and he continued. But it seemed as though his memory had gone on working in the interval, for his story was further advanced. I was about to call him back to the point, but Van Helsing whispered to me, "Let him go on. Do not interrupt him. He cannot go back, and maybe could not proceed at all if once he lost the thread of his thought. He proceeded. "All day I waited to hear from him, but he did not send me anything, not even a blowfly, and when the moon got up, I was pretty angry with him. He slid in through the window, though it was shut, and did not even knock. I got mad with him. He sneered at me, and his white face looked out of the mist with his red eyes gleaming, and he went on as though he owned the whole place and I was no one. He didn't even smell the same as he went by me. I couldn't hold him. I thought that somehow Mrs. Harker had come into the room." The two men sitting on the bed stood up and came over, standing behind them so he could not see them, but where they could hear better. They were both silent, and the professor started and quivered. His face, however, grew grimmer and sterner still. Renfield went on without noticing. "When Mrs. Harker came in to see me this afternoon, she wasn't the same. It was like tea after the teapot had been watered." Here we all moved, but no one said a word. He went on. "I didn't know that she was here till she spoke, and she didn't look the same. I don't care for the pale people. I like them with lots of blood in them. And hers seemed all to have run out. I didn't think of it at the time, but when she went away, I began to think, and it made me mad to know that he had been taking the life out of her. I could feel that the rest quivered, as I did, but we otherwise remained still. So when he came tonight, I was ready for him. I saw the mist stealing in, and I grabbed it tight. I've heard that madmen have unnatural strength, and as I knew I was a madman, at times anyhow, I resolved to use my power. Aye, and he felt it too, for he had come out of the mist to struggle with me. I held it tight, and I thought I was going to win, for I didn't mean him to take any more of her life, till I saw his eyes. They burned into me, and my strength became like water. He slipped through it, and when I tried to cling to him, he raised me up and flung me down. There was a red cloud before me, and a noise like thunder, and the mist seemed to steal away under the door. His voice was becoming fainter, and his breath more stertorous. Van Helsing stood up instinctively. "We know the worst now," he said. "He is here, and we know his purpose. It may not be too late. Let us be armed, the same as we were the other night, but lose no time. There is not an instant to spare." There was no need to put our fear, nay, our conviction, into words. We shared them in common. We all hurried and took from our rooms the same things we had when we entered the Count's house. The professor had his ready, and as we met in the corridor, he pointed to them significantly as he said, "They never leave me, and they shall not till this unhappy business be over. Be wise also, my friends. It is no common enemy we deal with. Alas, alas, that the poor dear Madam Mina should suffer." He stopped, his voice breaking, and I do not know if rage or terror predominated in my own heart. Outside the Harker's door we paused. Art and Quincy held back, and the latter said, "Well, should we disturb her?" "We must," said Van Helsing grimly. "If the door be locked, I shall break it in." "May it not frighten her terribly? It's unusual to break into a lady's room." Van Helsing said solemnly, "You are always right, but this is life and death. All chambers are alike to the doctor, and even were they not, as they all are one to me tonight. Friend John, when I turn the handle, if the door does not open, do you put your shoulder down and shove, and you too, my friends. Now." He turned the handle as he spoke, but the door did not yield. We threw ourselves against it. With a crash, it burst open, and we almost fell headlong into the room. The professor did actually fall, and I saw across him as he gathered himself up from hands and knees. What I saw appalled me. I felt my hair rise, like bristles on the back of my neck, and my heart seemed to stand still. The moonlight was so bright that through the thick yellow blind, the room was light enough to see. On the bed, beside the window, lay Jonathan Harker, his face flushed and breathing heavily as though in a stupor. Kneeling on the near edge of the bed, facing outwards, was the white-clad figure of his wife. By her side stood a tall, thin man, clad in black. His face was turned from us, but the instant we saw, we all recognized the Count. In every way, even to the scar on his forehead. With his left hand, he held both of Miss Harker's hands, keeping them away from her arms at full tension. His right hand gripped her by the back of the neck, forcing her face down on his bosom. Her white nightdress was smeared with blood, and a thin stream trickled down the man's bare breast, which was shown by his torn-open dress. The attitude of the two had a terrible resemblance to a child forcing a kitten's nose into a saucer of milk to compel it to drink. As we burst into the room, the Count turned his face, and the hellish look that I heard describe seemed to leap into it. His eyes flamed red with devilish passion, the great nostrils of his white aquiline nose opened wide and quivered at the edge, and the sharp white teeth behind the full lips of the blood-dripping mouth champed together like those of a wild beast. With a wrench, he threw his victim back upon the bed, as though hurled from a height. He turned and sprang at us. But by this time, the professor had gained his feet, and was holding towards him the envelope which contained the sacred wafer. The count suddenly stopped, just as poor Lucy had done outside the tomb, and cowered back. Further and further back he cowered, as we, lifting our crucifixes, advanced. The moonlight suddenly failed, as a great black cloud sailed across the sky, and when the gaslight sprang up under Quincy's match, we saw nothing but a faint vapor. This, as we looked, trailed under the door, which, with the recoil from its bursting open, had swung back into its old position. Van Helsing, Art, and I moved forward to Mrs. Harker, who by this time had drawn her breath, and with it had given a scream so wild, so ear-piercing, so despairing, that it seems to me now it will ring in my ears to my dying day. For a few seconds she lay in her helpless attitude in disarray. Her face was ghastly, with a pallor which was accentuated by the blood which smeared her lips and cheeks and chin. From her throat trickled a thin stream of blood. Her eyes were mad with terror. Then she put before her face her poor crushed hands, which bore on their whiteness the red mark of the Count's terrible grip. And from behind them came a low, desolate wail, which made the terrible scream seem only the expression of an endless grief. Van Helsing stepped forward and drew the coverlet gently over her body, whilst Art, while looking at her face for an instant, despairingly ran out of the room. Van Helsing whispered to me, "Jonathan is in such a stupor, such as we know the vampire can produce. We can do nothing with poor Madame Mina for a few moments until she recovers herself. I must wake him." He dipped the end of a towel in cold water and began to flick him on the face. His wife, all the while holding her face between her hands and sobbing in a way that was heartbreaking to hear. I raised the blind and looked out of the window. There was much moonshine, and as I looked, I could see Quincy Morris run across the lawn and hide himself in the shadow of a great yew tree. It puzzled me to think why he was doing this, but at the instant I heard Harker's quick exclamation as he woke to partial consciousness and turned to the bed. On his face, as there might well be, was a look of wild amazement. He seemed dazed for a few seconds, then in full consciousness seemed to burst upon him at once, and he started up. His wife was aroused by the quick movement and turned to him with her arms stretched out, as though to embrace him. Instantly, however, she drew them in again, and putting her elbows together, held her hands before her face and shuddered until the bed beneath her shook. "In God's name, what does this mean?" Harker cried out. "Dr. Seward? Dr. Van Helsing, what is it? What has happened? What is wrong? Mina, dear, what is this? What does the blood mean? My God, has it come to this?" And then, raising to himself to his knees, he beat his hands wildly together. "Good God, help us! Help her! Oh, help her!" With a quick movement, he jumped from the bed and began to pull on his clothes. All the man in him awake at the need for instant exertion. "What has happened? Tell me all about it," he cried without pausing. "Dr. Van Helsing, you love Mina, I know. Oh, do something to save her. It cannot have gone too far yet. Guard her while I look for him." His wife, through her terror and horror and distress, saw some sure danger to him, instantly forgetting her own grief, seized hold of him and cried out, "No, no, Jonathan, you must not leave me. I've suffered enough tonight, God knows, without the dread of his harming you. You must stay with me, stay with these friends who will watch over you." Her expression became frantic as she spoke, and he, yielding to her, she pulled him down, sitting on the bedside, and clung to him fiercely. Van Helsing and I tried to calm them both. The professor held up his little golden crucifix and said, with such wonderful calmness, "Do not fear, my dear. We are here. And whilst this is close for you, no foul thing can approach. You are safe for tonight, and we must be calm and take counsel together." She shuddered and was silent, holding down her head on her husband's breast. When she raised it, his white nightrobe was stained with blood where her lips touched, and where the thin open wound in her neck had sent forth drops. The instant she saw it, she drew back with a low wail and whispered, almost choking sobs, "Unclean, unclean. I must touch him or kiss him no more. Oh, that it should be that it is I who am now his worst enemy, and whom he may have most cause to fear. To this, he spoke out resolutely. Nonsense, Mina. It is a shame to me to hear such a word. I would not hear it of you, and I shall not hear it of you. May God judge me by my deserts, or punish me for more bitter suffering than ever this hour, if by any act or will of mine anything could come between us. He put out his arms and folded her to his breast, and after a while she lay there sobbing. He looked at us over her bowed head, and eyes that blinked damply above his quivering nostrils. His mouth was set as steel. After a while, her sobs became less frequent and more faint, and then he said to me, speaking with a studied calmness which I felt tried his nervous power almost to the utmost, "And now, Dr. Seward, tell me all about it. Too well I know the broad fact. Tell me all that has been." I told him exactly what had happened, and he listened with seeming impassiveness, but his nostrils twitched and his eyes blazed as I told him how the ruthless hands of the Count had held his wife in that terrible and horrid position, with her mouth to the open wound at his breast. It interested me, even in that moment, to see that, whilst the face of white-set passion worked convulsively over the bowed head, his hands tenderly and lovingly stroked the ruffled hair. Just as I had entered, Quincy and Godalming knocked at the door. They entered in obedience to our summons. Van Helsing looked at me questioningly. I understood him to mean that if we were to take advantage of their coming to divert, if possible, the thoughts of the unhappy husband and wife from each other and from themselves, so on nodding acquiescence to him, he asked them what they'd seen or done. To which Lord Godalming answered, "I could not see him anywhere in the passage or in any of the rooms. I looked in the study, but though he had been there, he had gone. He had, however..." He stopped, suddenly, looking up at the poor, drooping figure on the bed. Van Helsing said gravely, "Go on, friend Arthur. We want here no more concealments. Our hope now is in knowing all. Tell freely." So Art went on. "He had been there, and though it could have only been for a few seconds, he made rare hay of the place. All the manuscript had been burned, and the blue flames were flickering amongst the white ashes. The cylinders of your phonograph, too, were thrown in the fire, and the wax had helped the flames." Here I interrupted, "Thank God the other copy's safe." His face lit up for a moment, but fell again as he went down on. I ran downstairs then, but could see no sign of him. I looked into Renfield's room, but there was no trace there except... Again he paused. "Go on," said Harker hoarsely, so he bowed his head and, moistening his lips with his tongue, added, "except that the poor fellow is dead." Mrs. Harker raised her head, looking from one to the other of us as she said solemnly, "God's will be done." I could not but feel that Art was keeping back something, but as I took it that it was with a purpose, I said nothing. Van Helsing turned to Morris and said, "And you, friend Quincy, do you have any more to tell?"
"A little," he answered. "It may be much eventually, but at present I can't say. I thought it well to know, if possible, where the Count would go if he left the house. I did not see him, but I saw a bat rise from Renfield's window and flap westward. I expected to see him in some shape go back to Carfax, but he evidently sought some other lair. He will not be back tonight. The sky is reddening in the east and the dawn is close. We must work tomorrow."
He said the latter words through his shut teeth. For a space of perhaps a couple of minutes there was silence, and I could fancy that I could hear the sound of our hearts beating. Then Van Helsing said, placing his hand very tenderly on Miss Harker's head, "And now, Madam Mina, poor, poor, dear Madam Mina, tell us exactly what happened." "God knows that I do not want you to be pained, but it is need that we know all. For now, more than ever, has all work to be done quick and sharp, and in deadly earnest. The day is close to us that must end all, if it be may so be, and now is the chance that we may live and learn." The poor, dear lady shivered, and I could see the tension of her nerves as she clasped her husband closer to her and bent her head lower and lower still on his breast. And then she raised her head proudly and held out one hand to Van Helsing, who took it in his, and after stooping and kissing it reverently, held it fast. The other hand was locked in that of her husband, who held his other arm thrown round her protectingly. After a pause in which she was evidently ordering her thoughts, she began. I took this sleeping draught which you had so kindly given me, but for a long time it did not act. I seemed to become more wakeful, and myriads of horrible fancies began to crowd in upon my mind, all of them connected with death and vampires and blood and pain and trouble. Her husband involuntarily groaned as she turned to him and said lovingly, "Do not fret, dear. You must be brave and strong and help me get through this terrible task. If only you knew what an effort it is for me to tell of this fearful thing at all, you would understand how much I need your help." Well, I saw I must try to help the medicine to its work with my will if it were to do me any good, so I resolutely set myself to sleep. Sure enough, sleep must soon have come upon me, for I remember no more. Jonathan, coming in, had not waked me, for he lay by my side when next I remember. There was in the room the same thin white mist that I had noticed before. But I forget now if you know of this. You will find it in my diary, which I will show you later. I felt the same vague terror which had come to me before, and the same sense of some presence. I turned to wake Jonathan, but found he slept so soundly it seemed as if it was he who had taken the sleeping draught, and not I. I tried, but I could not wake him. This caused me a great fear, and I looked around terrified. Then, indeed, my heart sank within me, beside the bed, as if he had stepped out of the mist, or rather, as if the mist had turned into his figure, for it had entirely disappeared, stood a tall, thin man, all in black. I knew him at once from the description of the others. The waxen face, the high aquiline nose on which the light fell in a thin white line, the parted red lips with the sharp white teeth showing between, and the red eyes that it seemed to me to see in the sunset on the windows of St. Mary's Church at Whitby. I knew, too, the red scar on his forehead where Jonathan had struck him. For an instant my heart stood still, and I would have screamed out, only that I was paralyzed. In the pause he spoke in a sort of keen, cutting whisper, pointing as he spoke to Jonathan. "Silence! If you make a sound, I shall take him and dash his brains out before your very eyes." I was appalled and too bewildered to do or say anything. With a mocking smile, he placed one hand upon my shoulder and, holding me tight, bared my throat with the other, saying as he did so, "First, a little refreshment to reward my exertions. You may as well be quiet. It is not the first time, or the second, that your veins have appeased my thirst." I was bewildered, and strangely enough, I did not want to hinder him. I suppose it is a part of the horrible curse that such is when his touch is placed upon the victim. And oh my God, pity me! He placed his reeking lips upon my throat. Her husband groaned again. She clasped his hand harder and looked at him pityingly, as though he were the injured one, and went on. I felt my strength fading away, and I was in a half-swoon. How long this horrible thing lasted, I know not. It seemed that a long time must have passed before he took his foul, awful, sneering mouth away. I saw it drip with the fresh blood. The remembrance seemed for a while to overpower her, and she drooped and would have sunk down but for her husband's sustaining arm. With a great effort, she recovered herself and went on. Then he spoke to me mockingly, "And so you, like the others, would play your brains against mine. You would help these men to hunt me and frustrate me in my designs. You know now, and they know in part already, and will know in full before long, what it is to cross my path. They should have kept their energies for use closer to home, whilst they played wits against me who commanded nations and intrigued for them and fought for them hundreds of years before they were born. I was countermining them. And you, their best beloved one,
are now to me flesh of my flesh, blood of my blood, kin of my kin, my bountiful winepress for a while, and shall be, later on, my companion and my helper. You shall be avenged in turn, for not one of them, but shall minister to your needs. But as yet, you are to be punished for what you've done. You've aided in thwarting me. Now you shall come to my call. When my brain says come to you, you shall cross land or sea to do my bidding, and to that end, this. With that, he pulled open his shirt, and with his long, sharp nails opened a vein in his breast. When the blood began to spurt out, he took my hands in his, holding them tight, and with the other hand seized my neck and pressed my mouth to the wound so that I must either suffocate or swallow some of the... Oh my God! My God, what have I done? What have I done to deserve such a fate? I who have tried to walk in meekness and righteousness all of my days? God pity me! Look down on a poor soul in worse than mortal peril, and in mercy pity those to whom she is dear. Then she began to rub her lips as though to cleanse them from pollution. As she was telling her terrible story, the eastern sky began to quicken, and everything became more and more clear. Harker was still and quiet, but over his face, as the awful narrative went on, came a gray look which deepened and deepened in the morning light. Till when the first red streak of the coming dawn shot up, the flesh stood darkly out against the whitening hair. We have arranged that one of us is to stay within call of the unhappy pair till we can meet together and arrange about talking action. Of this I'm sure. The sun rises today on no more miserable house in all the great round of its daily course. Jonathan Harker's Journal, 3rd of October. As I must do something, or go mad, I write this diary. It is now 6 o'clock, and we are to meet in the study in half an hour and take something to eat, for Dr. Van Helsing and Dr. Seward are agreed that if we do not eat, we cannot work our best. Our best will be, God knows, required today. I must keep writing at every chance, for I dare not stop to think. All, big and little, must go down. Perhaps, at the end, the little things may teach us most. The teaching, big or little, could not have landed Mina or me anywhere worse than we are today. However, we must trust and hope. Poor Mina told me just now, with the tears running down her dear cheeks, that it is in trouble and trial that our faith is tested, that we must keep on trusting, and that God will aid us up to the end. The end! Oh my God, what end? To work, to work! When Dr. Van Helsing and Dr. Seward had come back from seeing poor Renfield, we went gravely into what was to be done. First, Dr. Seward told us that when he and Dr. Van Helsing had gone down to the room below, they found Renfield lying on the floor all in a heap. His face was all bruised and crushed in, and the bones of the neck were broken. Dr. Seward asked the attendant who was on duty if he'd heard anything. He said that he'd been sitting down. He confessed to half-dozing when he heard loud voices in the room. And then Renfield had called out loudly several times, God, God, God. And after that, there was a sound of falling. And when he entered the room, he found him lying on the floor, face down, just as the doctors had seen him. Dr. Van Helsing asked if he had heard voices or a voice, and he said he could not say, that at first it seemed to him as if there were two, but as there was no one else in the room, it could have only been one. He could swear to it, if required, that the word God was spoken by the patient. Dr. Seward said to us when we were alone that he did not wish to go into the matter. The question of an inquest had to be considered, and it would never do to put forward the truth as one would believe it. As it was, he thought that on the attendant's evidence he could give a certificate of death by misadventure in falling from bed. In case the coroner should demand it, there would be a formal inquest, necessarily to the same result. When the question began to be discussed as to what should be our next step, the very first thing we decided was that Mina should be in full confidence, that nothing of the sort, no matter how painful, should be kept from her. She herself agreed to, its wisdom, and it was pitiful to see her so brave, and yet so sorrowful, and in such a depth of despair. There must be no more concealment, she said. Alas, we've had too much already.
And besides, there's nothing in all the world that can give me more pain than I've already endured, that I suffer now. Whatever may happen, it must be of new hope or new courage to me. Van Helsing was looking at her fixedly as she spoke, and said, suddenly but very quietly, "But dear Madam Mina, are you not afraid? Not for yourself, but for others, from yourself, after what has happened." Her face grew set in the lines, but her eyes shone with the devotion of a martyr as she answered, "No, for my mind is made up." "To what?" he asked gently, whilst we were all very still, for each in our own way we had a sort of vague idea of what she meant. Her answer came with direct simplicity, as though she were simply stating a fact. "Because if I find in myself, and I shall watch keenly for it, a sign of harm to any that I love, I shall die." "You would not kill yourself?" he asked hoarsely. "I would, if there were no friend who loved me, who would save me such a pain in so desperate an effort." She looked at him meaningly as she spoke. He was sitting down, but now he rose and came close to her and put his head on her hand as he said solemnly, "My child, there is such a one, if it would be to your good. For myself, I could hold it in my account with God to find such a euthanasia for you, even at this moment, if it were best, nay, were it safe. But my child..." For a moment he seemed to choke, and a great sob rose in his throat. He gulped it down and went on, "There are here some who would not stand between you and death. You must not die. You must not die by any hand, but least of all by your own. Until the other, who's fouled your sweet life, is true dead, you must not die. For if he is still with the quick undead, your death would make you even as he is. No, you must live. You must struggle and strive to live, though death would seem a boon unspeakable. You must fight death himself, though he come to you in pain or in joy, by the day or the night, in safety or in peril. On your living soul I charge you that you do not die, nay, nor think of death, till this great evil be past." The poor dear grew white as death, and shook and shivered as I have seen a quicksand shake and shiver at the incoming of the tide. We were all silent. We could say nothing. At length she grew more calm, and turning to him said sweetly, but oh, so sorrowfully, as she held out her hand, "I promise you, my dear friend, that if God will let me live, I shall strive to do so, till, if it may be in his good time, this horror have passed away from me. She was so good and brave that we all felt our hearts were strengthened to work and endure for her, and we began to discuss what we were to do. I told her that she was to have all of the papers in the safe, all of the papers or diaries or phonographs we might hereafter use, and was to keep the record, as she had done before. She was pleased with the prospect of anything to do, if pleased could be used in connection with so grim an interest. As usual, Dr. Van Helsing had thought about ahead of everyone else and was prepared to do an exact ordering of our work. "It is perhaps well," he said, "that at our meeting, after our visit to Carfax, we decided not to do anything with the earth boxes that lay there. Had we done so, the Count must have guessed our purpose, and would doubtless have taken measures to advance to frustrate such an effort with regard to the others. But now he does not know our intentions. Nay, more, in all probability, he does not know that such a power exists to us as can sterilize his lairs, so that he cannot use them as of old. We are now so much further advanced in our knowledge as to their disposition that, when we have examined the house in Piccadilly, we may track the very last of them. Today, then, is ours, and in it rests our hope. The sun that rose in our sorrow this morning guards us in its course. Until it sets tonight, that monster must retain whatever form he now has. He is confined to within the limitations of his earthly envelope. He cannot melt into thin air, nor disappear through cracks or chinks or crannies. If he go through a doorway, he must open the door like a mortal. And so,
We have this day to hunt out all his lairs and sterilize them. And so we shall. If we have not yet catch him and destroy him, drive him to bay in some place where the catching and the destroying shall be in time, sure. Here I started up, for I could not contain myself at the thought that the minutes and seconds so preciously laden with Mina's life and happiness were flying from us, since, whilst we talk, action was possible. But Van Helsing held up his hand warningly. "Nay, friend Jonathan," he said, "in this, the quickest way home is the longest way, as your proverbs say. We shall all act, and act with desperate quick when the time has come. But think, in all probable, the key of the situation is in that house in Piccadilly. The Count may have many houses which he have bought. Of them, he will have deeds of purchase, keys, and other things. He will have paper that he write on. He will have his book of checks. There are many belongings which he must have, somewhere. Why not in this place so central, so quiet, where he come and go by the front or the back all hour, when the very vast of traffic there is none to notice? We shall go there and search that house, and when we learn what it holds, then we do what our friend Arthur call, in his phrases of hunt, stop the earths. And so we run down our old fox. Is it not?" "Then let us come at once," I cried. "We're wasting the precious, precious time." The professor did not move, but simply said, "And how are we to get into that house in Piccadilly?" "Anyway," I cried, "we shall break in if need be." "And your police? Where will they be? What will they say?" I was staggered, but I knew that if he wished to delay, he had a good reason for it. So I said, as quietly as I could, "Don't wait any more than need be. You know, I'm sure, what torture I'm in." "Ah, my child, that I do. And indeed, there is no wish of me to add to your anguish. But just think, what can we do until all the world be in movement? Then will come our time. I have thought and thought, and it seems to me the simplest way is best of all. Now we wish to get into the house, but we have no key. Is that not so?" I nodded. "Now suppose that you were, in truth, the owner of that house, and could still not get it, and think there was to you no conscience of the housebreaker, what would you do?"
"I should get a respectable locksmith, and set him to work to pick the lock for me."
"And your police, they would interfere, would they not?"
"Oh, no. Not if they knew the man was properly employed."
"Then," he looked at me keenly as he spoke, "all that is in doubt is the conscience of the employer, and the belief of your policeman as to whether or no that employer has a good conscience or a bad one. Your police must indeed be zealous men and clever, oh, so clever in reading the heart, that they trouble themselves in such matter. No, no, my friend Jonathan, you must take the lock off 100 empty house in this your London, or in any city of the world, and if you do it as such things are rightly done, and at the time such things are rightly done, no one will interfere. I have read of a gentleman who owned so fine a house in your London that he went for months of summer in Switzerland and lock up his house. Some burglar came and broke window and back and got in, and then he went and made open the shutters in front and walk in and out through the door before the very eyes of the police. And then he have an auction in that house and advertise it and put up big notice. And when the day come, he sell off by a great auctioneer all the goods the other man who owned them. He go to a builder and sell him that house, making an agreement that he pull it down and take it away within a certain time. And your police and other authority help him all they can. And when that owner come back from his holiday in Switzerland, he find only an empty hole where his house had been. This had been en règle, and in our work, we should be done en règle too. We shall not go so early that the policemen have then little to think of, shall deem it strange. We shall go after 10 o'clock, when there are many about, and which such things would be done if we were indeed owners of that house."
This has been Rachel reading Bookshelf, with part 12 of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Have a wonderful day.